I had a happy childhood.
No.
But I've never seen the world in my lifetime in as dire a state as I think is today. I always thought of myself as a member of the happy, lucky post-war generation. Now, yes. I'm not so sure that we are post-war.
No. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul Taylor. Thank you.
All the best, Bert.
Thank you. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
To town with his wagon broken down. The farmer is.
Tune in to the Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's the Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, now through December 31st.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
One of the things that I always point out to people is that you don't need to be famous Native American to be in the Hall of Fame. And it's not a popularity contest. It's all about what you've achieved or what you've done that has been a significant contribution to Native Americans or even just people in your state or community. And so you can be somebody that nobody's ever heard of and still make it in the Hall of Fame if we feel that what you've done is significant enough.
I'm Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, host of Indigenous in the News in Bradenton, Florida, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Today on Sprouts, we speak with James Parker Shield of the Little Shell Chippewa Tribe. He is the founder and CEO of the National Native American Hall of Fame. He has dedicated his life to honoring Indigenous excellence, transforming a vision into a national institution, celebrating Indigenous leaders, artists, and trailblazers. From journalism to public service to building the Hall of Fame, he continues to uplift stories that inspire Native communities across the country.
We are excited to have you here today. Welcome to our show, James.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. Welcome, James. Hello.
Thank
hello.
You. Hello out there to all you skins in Indian country.
Yeah.
All right. So, James, let's get started. Can you share a little bit about your early life and how those experiences shaped your vision for the future?
Well, you know, I'm from Little Shell Chippewa and Cree tribes in Montana. I spent part of my youth on the Rocky Boy Reservation. I also lived in a Indian community that was outside the city of Great Falls called Watermill Hill. And my mom was the Little Shell Chippewa and Cree. My dad was Turtle Mountain Chippewa. And unfortunately, like most of the other people around us, they like to drink and they like to party. And sometimes they would basically ask people to watch us kids. There was three of us. And, you know, they'd be gone for days at a time, or sometimes a week at a time, sometimes longer. And then one day when I was 5 years old, they never came back. So we found ourselves classified as abandoned kids.
Oh, no.
And we were put into foster homes and bounced around, and then ended up in the what used to be the state orphanage. It was pretty much about 70% Native American. And the stories were pretty similar to ours, mm-hmm. you know, dysfunctional families and neglected kids. And that's where I stayed until the ninth grade. And of course, like a lot of other kids in that situation, especially Indian kids that were in an institution that was across the river from a rural white town that didn't like us, we didn't like them. And then we had to go to high school in that town school. You know, it was very apparent that they didn't want us there and we didn't want to be there. So you always got in trouble. You always got in a lot of fights. So no big surprise at the end of my ninth grade year, I was asked not to come back. They expelled me from school. And so there I was, but I was still a ward of the state. So the folks at the Children's Center had to figure out what to do with me. And a couple of Crow kids, they got in trouble at the same time, got kicked out of school as well. So the three of us ended up getting shipped off to an all-Indian job corps at Kicking Horse on the Flathead Reservation in Montana. So I was one of the first 50 Indians that was in this job corps that was run by the people in the Flathead Reservation. And, you know, just played basketball, got on their boxing team, and actually got a GED.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Those were some struggles. How did they influence your path into leadership and service?
I think the subsequent years, they were pretty rocky as well, drifting around and in and out of trouble. And I think the only thing that was a positive in all of my younger years growing up was that on the outside, I was a troublemaker and getting in fights just to stand up for myself, I always thought. But really, on the inside, I was a closet bookworm. I read all the time. And of course, back in those days, in the early 60s, there wasn't a large amount of material out there about Native Americans or Native American individuals. So whenever I'd run across something in the school library, you know, I would jump on it. So I read the books on Crazy Horse, Osceola, Chief Joseph, Jim Thorpe, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the only contemporary Indian role model offered up at the time. And on television, of course, was Tonto from The Lone Ranger of Tonto. But pretty sparse pickings as far as role models and inspirational figures. But still yet, as a young Indian, that was at least something that you could hang on to and kind of look to. So even after I returned to my hometown in Great Falls, Montana, it was a big deal for me to see an Indian waitress working in a cafe.
Oh, sure.
We didn't have high school graduates or college Indians. This was all before that ever started. Mm-hmm. And pretty much everybody I knew in the Indian community dropped out of school or got kicked out of school around 9th, 10th grade. So what happened to me was no different. You know, I was just like everybody else. And the very first place that I saw a difference was when I made up my mind when I was 19. I thought, I want to get out, see the world a bit. And so I actually hitchhiked in the middle of winter. And I thought, I'll just head south, any place that's warm. And lo and behold, I climbed off a semi-truck in downtown Oklahoma City. And I was looking for work. I was walking the streets, sleeping in the park, looking for dishwashing or swamping jobs. And couldn't find anything. And certainly didn't have any education to speak of, but I kept at it and then finally got into a trade school where I became a medical transcriptionist, they called it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was my first fancy job.
Nice.
And I was constantly surprised and impressed by the Indians I met in Oklahoma because they were light years ahead of our people back home. I mean, the first time I ever saw an Indian drive a new car was in Oklahoma. First time I ever saw an Indian wearing a suit and tie was in Oklahoma. And I was meeting a lot of Indians down here that had college educations. It was an eye-opening experience for me. And so when a couple of my friends, they were going to go visit a relative of theirs that worked at the BIA in D.C., they invited me along. I wanted to go see the world, so I wanted to see D.C. too. So I just jumped in and ran smack into another eye-opening experience for the next couple of years in Washington, D.C. And keep in mind, this is like at the height of the Indian movement, early 70s. And I hit town. I ended up dating a gal there that was Hopi. Her mom worked at the National Congress of American Indians. And pretty soon I'm being introduced and hanging around people like LaDonna Harris, who was married to Senator Frank Harris at the time, and she was a Comanche from Oklahoma. Ada Deer had her Menominee Restoration movement going, and her office was right in D.C. There was a numerous, what I call, you know, storefront Indian organizations that were fighting for Indian rights. And of course, AIM was very active. And so I got to know all the AIM leaders because they would come in and out of D.C. to propagandize their movement or raise funds or rally the troops. And at the same time, the Alaska Native Claims Act was being debated in Congress. And you'd see this delegation of people traipsing by, and it would be pointed out to me by one of my friends. They'd say, oh, that's the Alaskan delegation. And they were all lobbying for rights and retribution and land claims. And it was an exciting time. Probably the most important person in my life that I met was Ernie Stevens Sr. Ernie Stevens Sr. was an important figure in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He was kind of like the rebel trying to chain paternalistic organization from the inside. And then you had people fighting the battle from outside the system. And so it was very interesting times. I got to watch and meet so many of these different people, especially when Ernie Stevens kind of took me under his wing and mentored me and would spend time talking to me. And so as a result of that, I decided I want to be like these people. Right, I want to be an Indian that's fighting for our cause and make things better for my people back home. So I decided to go back to Montana and go on a straight and narrow, behave and go to college and try to become like some of these people that I admired.
Right.
So what was the turning point that led to you to create the National Native American Hall of Fame?
Boredom.
Boredom?
Well, if you ever try retirement, you know, I retired.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything slows down. I felt like there was something missing. And
Sure.
And you don't see a lot of people, especially if you're doing something like raising cattle. So I remember standing down by my barn, looking around at the mountains, and this nice scenery and the cows. And I was happy with that, but I was thinking to myself, you know, I feel like I kind of walked away and maybe there's something I didn't do. And I remember I had this Hall of Fame idea years before.
Vision. Good vision.
Yeah. And I thought somebody would do it because it was such an obvious omission. I thought, how come there's not a Native American Hall of Fame? There's a Hall of Fame for everybody else. I mean,
Brian.
There's not even a Hall of Fame for dog catchers, but not for Indians, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, somebody's going to do it because it's so obvious. You know, I'm not inventing anything new here. And nobody did it. And so another couple of years goes by, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it. And, of course, the first thing I thought about, well, realistically, would I be able to do something like that? And I thought, boy, it'd be a long shot because I'm a senior citizen now and I have some notoriety in Montana, but outside of Montana, you know, nobody knows me. I've never done anything at the national level, hardly ever traveled out of Montana. And I just didn't think I'd be the one. But finally, I decided, well,
let's do it.
Maybe it's a question of me being stupid enough to try it. You know, maybe I look at the wrong set of skills here, the skill set. Maybe not being a great leader or national renown, well-connected, all that influential. No, what you need is somebody that's a senior citizen, not very bright, just ignorant enough to try something that, you know. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll see what I can do. And once I made up my mind, and then of course then I had to start doing the paperwork, you know, getting, you know, your nonprofit status, you know, get state incorporated and all that. And I can remember my first victim that I targeted because I knew I needed a board of directors was a good friend of mine. Those are the low-hanging fruit, you know. Mm-hmm. So the president of Stonechild College up on the Rocky Boy Reservation was Dr. Nate St. Pierre. Fortunately, the Montana Indian Education Conference was going on in Great Falls at the time, so I just went over to the hotel where they were holding it and waited for him to come out of where he had been just finished giving a presentation. I ambushed him in the hallway, and we went and sat down on a bench in the hallway. I pitched my idea to him, and he said, yeah, I'd like to help, James. What can I do for you? I said, I'd like you to be my first board member. And he said, okay, sign me up. Very nice. Yeah, he was a good friend, nice guy, good-hearted. Then one of the few people that I knew from the national level that he in turn had a number of contacts was Harlan McCosato, who had been the host of the radio program Native America Calling for a number of years, Albuquerque. And I called him up and pitched the idea to him, and he said, I'm on board. And he's, I'll help you recruit board members. And I said, great. So he got me some other national board members, and we were off and running.
Wow, I like that story. You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local productions of global interest. I'm Larry Kay, host of Indigenous in the News, and today's topic, honoring Indigenous excellence, James Parker Shield and the Native American Hall of Fame.
Why was it important for you to focus on contemporary Native achievements from the Civil War era to the present day?
Well, I just felt that contemporary Indians needed to have more notice because, sadly enough, when schools or television programs, whenever they cover anything on Native Americans, they automatically revert to the old days, you know, the buffalo days, the teepee days, or Indian war days.
Right.
And we're living in a modern world now, and we have young people that need to learn about more contemporary Indians and their great achievements. And the reason why I chose the Civil War as a starting point was because that's kind of a unique point in history for Native Americans, because you had Native Americans fighting on both sides of the Civil War. But more importantly, most people don't realize that an Indian wrote the surrender agreement that ended the Civil War.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
A Seneca Indian by the name of Ely Parker, who was a lawyer but was not allowed to practice law because you had to be a citizen of the country in order to practice law. And so he couldn't hang out a shingle. So he went back and got an engineering degree, ended up in the Army Corps of Engineers building bridges until the Civil War broke out. And then he ended up on General Grant's staff and rose to the rank of Brigadier General himself. And when General Lee and Grant met at Appomattox Courthouse, they had a contingent of officers with them. And Ely Parker was there, and he was the most educated guy in the room. Nobody surprised, they asked him, you know, to draft up the terms of surrender, which he did on the spot. And General Lee is reputed to have remarked when he looked at Ely, he said, well, I'm glad to see there's one real American in this room. You know, kind of a nod of recognition to Native Americans being the first Americans.
Now, the Hall of Fame holds induction ceremonies. Can you describe what those events feel like and the significance they carry?
It's pretty typical of any Hall of Fame induction ceremony. You have a banquet, and so get to eat good food. You show intro videos of the person that helps people understand why they're being inducted, and people applaud wildly and madly, and then that person gets up there and makes a great speech.
When was the first year?
We formed the organization in 2016. We held our first induction ceremony in 2018 in Phoenix, Arizona at the old Phoenix Indian School, because I wanted to pay honor to those Indians that have gone through the boarding school experience. And since that time, we've held all of our induction ceremonies in Oklahoma.
So now where do you hold them?
We've usually held them for the past number of years at the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City, and next door to that, the brand new Okana Resort and Water Park that was built by the Chickasaw Nation is where we're holding it at this year. You can come celebrate the induction of one of your relatives into the Hall of Fame and immediately go out and get on the beach or in a cabana or go down a water slide.
Sure, sure. How cool is that?
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about your partnership with the museum.
Yeah. We had a grant that we got so that we were able to work with a curator here at the First American Museum in developing a manual for how you handle collections and archives. Because in the future, we want to be able to have space enough and develop the appropriate facilities and environmental controls to collect important papers, documents, items like Joy Harjo's saxophone.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to add things to our exhibits so that people will learn more and get a deeper appreciation for each of our inductees.
The Hall of Fame highlights leaders from all walks of life, athletes, activists, artists, educators. How do you decide who to induct each year?
Well, the board of directors makes the final determination about who gets selected.
Okay.
I put together a short list of about 20 names after I go through everybody that we have in our big pool of names. And then I try to make sure we use a matrix with points. And we pay attention to things like how many people we already have in one particular category. We pay attention to gender balance, tribal balance. We try not to overload in any particular area. And then I forward those 20 names along with all their information to the board, and then they meet and they come up with the final six names for each year.
Break it down. How many awardees do you have?
With the six that's going in this year, we'll have a total of 59.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, heading the ticket this year is Deb Holland, recent Secretary of Interior.
Mm-hmm.
Nota Begay, the PGA golfer.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
We have the fastest Native American to ski downhill.
Whoa.
He's actually the fastest person in America.
Wow.
And we have a Medal of Honor winner in Dwight Birdwell. And then we have a longtime national and tribal leader, Ron Allen, from Jamestown, Skyline. And then, of course, everybody in the Indian gaming world knows Lynn Valbuena from the San Manuel Nation.
James, how do you balance recognizing figures like Jim Thorpe and Joy Harjo with lifting up lesser-known but equally impacted leaders? I know Joy's been on my radio show, so I really like her music.
Yeah, with that saxophone of hers.
Yeah. And so how do you balance recognizing these figures?
One of the things that I always point out to people is that you don't need to be famous Native American to be in the Hall of Fame. And it's not a popularity contest. It's all about what you've achieved or what you've done that has been a significant contribution to Native Americans or even just people in your state or community. And so you can be somebody that nobody's ever heard of and still make it in the Hall of Fame if we feel that what you've done is significant enough.
So which inductees' stories have especially moved you in some sort of way?
I'd say three of them right off the top of my head. So obviously my mentor, Ernie Stevens Sr., is in the Hall of Fame. He's one of those people that was well-known, held some really big-time positions. That's kind of more typical of the kind of people that we have in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of other people are people that people are surprised. One was Catherine Siva Sobel. She was from Morongo. And she dedicated her whole life to preserving her tribe's language. Saving and preserving the Morongo language was very important. And she also established their museum. So that's one of them. The other one, this was back, I think, 21 or 22. We had a star-laden group of people. We had Ben Nighthorse Campbell. We had Rick West. We had Joy Harjo. I mean, we just had some real big names.
Nice.
Everybody. And one name there that was not a big name, but she made it through our process. And she was a nurse, an Indian nurse. But more importantly, she was a nurse during World War II, and she was at the Normandy invasion in a field hospital. She was also at the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm.
And then she went home to South Dakota on her reservation and served her people for over 30 years. And she was quite the person. And then we find out that she's 102 years old.
Oh, wow.
And she's still alive.
Incredible. Wow. I like it.
No, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I got a hold of her family, and I talked to her daughter and her niece, And they said, yeah, her health is holding up. She's in a wheelchair. And I said, well, do you think she'd be able to make it down to the ceremony? And they said, yeah, she wants to come.
Nice.
And I would keep checking, you know, with them every few weeks to see how she was doing and if she was still going to be able to make it to the ceremony. You know, her health, it's going down, but she's hanging in there because she's looking forward to being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, right on.
It feels good to recognize people and then watch how pleased their tribes and their families are.
Yeah.
A lot of them were almost nearly forgotten, and we can't allow that to happen. So that's the main purpose of the Hall of Fame, is to keep their names and their achievements in people's minds.
So, James, how do you think that the Native youth can learn from the lives of these inductees into the Hall of Fame?
I think, quite simply, all Indians automatically have that shared history, those shared experiences, you know, that we as Indians are familiar with. It doesn't matter what tribe you are. It seems like, you know, a lot of people grew up poor. They faced discrimination. They were not always the best educated. But they always maintained their sense of humor as well. That's what binds us together.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I think it's important for young people to know that these are people that automatically you can make a connection with. A lot of them have had to deal with the issues that you're dealing with as a young person right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not alone in this world. And I always say, don't use the color of your skin as an excuse to fail. Use it as a reason to succeed, to achieve. And these are people that have done that. They don't let anything stop them. And some of them have fallen down more than once, even like our astronaut. At one point, he quit school. Yeah, you know, I think the majority of our people in the Hall of Fame have fallen down at least once in their life, probably more, and have gotten back up and continued on to become very successful.
Yes.
And that's important. Inspiration is important to young people.
Yes, and I like what you're doing, because growing up, you know, you mentioned we didn't have mentors, and here you are. You're bringing a list of them for us all to learn and make our own self-achievements. A lot of my listeners don't know, but my great-great-grandmother was the first Native American doctor, Susan LaFleche, and I like to hear that, you know, and just follow her lead in my life.
Yeah.
The Hall of Fame developed an inspirational leadership curriculum. How is it being used in schools, and what impact do you hope it has?
Well, one thing, it's at least bringing visibility in the classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a study that was done by Crystal Echohawk and her organization, where it showed that 80% of the schools in this country don't teach anything about Native Americans. The other percentage that do, it's basically very minimal, and a lot of times it's just stereotypical. So we try to offer a more up-to-date, you know, curriculum that can be used in schools, where all students, Native and non-Native, will learn about these inspirational individuals. And of course, since we induct people in 15 different categories, you know, pick your favorite area or what you're dreaming of becoming, and you'll find an Indian role model now.
Yes.
What do you hope people, Native and non-Native alike, take away after a visit at the Hall of Fame?
It can be all summed up in one remark. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there you go.
We've had so many people coming through looking at our displays, and I hear people, they didn't know that when I ate at Famous Dave's, the restaurant chain, that Famous Dave is an Indian?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I knew Jim Thorpe was an Olympian. I knew he played baseball, but I didn't know he was the first president or commissioner of the National Football League. And that's why the NFC Conference Championship Trophy is the Jim Thorpe Trophy.
You know what? I said that to Gary after talking to you in our first interview. I didn't know that. Is it growing every year?
Yes. Well, we keep the number in attendance right around about 250.
Okay.
But what increases is people's awareness of it and the support for it. And of course, you know, it just seems to me that every year I'm impressed by the group of people that are going into the Hall of Fame.
Right. Uh-oh. Right. Me and Gary are going to nominate each other.
I haven't done anything that great yet, man. I don't know, man. But I definitely think that Larry has, man. I mean, he's got like, you know.
Well, we'll be hooking it up.
There you go. Yep.
But, James, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. You know, I'm humbled, as always. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Learned so much today.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
James, thank you for your time today. I surely appreciate all the great work you're doing for our people. I give you the honors and salute. Stay in touch with us and have yourself a great week and safe journeys.
Okay. Will do. All right, guys. See ya.
Well, that's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Indigenous in the News with Larry Kay and Gary Wilcox, honoring Indigenous excellence, James Parker Shield, and the Native American Hall of Fame. A special thanks to our guest, James Parker Shield. Salute. Our contributors this week were Indigenous in the News with Larry Kay and Gary Wilcox, bringing you our show from our Bradenton and Miami studios. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your radio station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Larry Kay in Bradenton, Florida. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Today,